So the more we stop thinking about people with mental health issues in one category and healthy people in another category, and instead say we are all these people and we all benefit from the animal. And dogs are just a great way for your average person to open up and to feel like comfortable talking about the ways that those animals make them feel better and the way that our mental health differences can actually be strengths.
Welcome to the Beautifully Complex podcast, where I share insights and strategies on parenting neurodivergent kids straight from the trenches. I'm your host, Penny Williams. I'm a parenting coach, author, and mindset mama, honored to guide you on the journey of raising your atypical kid. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. I have with me Daniel Magler, and he is the mental health advisor for Paws for Patrick. And we are going to talk all about emotional support animals. What does it mean to have an emotional support animal? Who would benefit from an emotional support animal? How do you go about getting one? All of these questions that I think so many people have, we are going to try to answer for you here in this episode. But I want to start by having you introduce yourself. Who are you and what do you do?
Okay. Well, I'm Dan Magler, and I'm a high school social worker and a therapist in private practice. I have a podcast called Not Allowed to Die, which is a mental health podcast where I talk about how treatment works or sometimes doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And as you said, I'm the mental health advisor for Paws for Patrick, where I help educate people, regular families and therapists, about emotional support animals and how they work in supporting particularly young people to view their best selves. So that's a big part of what I do.
Yeah. You want to start with just telling us a little bit about Paws for Patrick, what that organization is and does, and maybe how it came about. And then I think we'll dive into talking specifics about emotional support animals.
Yeah. So in my role as a school social worker, I got to work with Patrick Romer, and I worked with him from his freshman through his senior year. And Patrick had a lot of challenges with depression, anxiety. And when Patrick was struggling, he wasn't the kind of kid who liked to share his feelings in a therapeutic setting. There might be days when he would be so overwhelmed and stressed out that he would come down to my office and he would just say, I just want to go home and be with Cece. And so we would find a way for him, because when he could be with Cece, his dog, he could pet her and hug her, and he could normalize his heart rate and he could feel more relaxed. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, during the pandemic, you know, I didn't get to have contact. He was a senior. It was his senior year. Mm-hmm. And Patrick was actually having a good experience with his family. They organized the Pet Olympics. They were bonding. But he had a really bad day in May of 2020. And he died by suicide that day. Mm-hmm. And again, for his family, for me, we were all, everyone who loved him was just so incredibly devastated. And a GoFundMe was created to try to help support the family. And the family said, we don't really need this money for ourselves. We want to do something that will honor Patrick's legacy. We know what we want it to be about, mental health and animals. And so the idea just came together to say, how can we get people that kind of support and nurturing that Patrick got from Cece to as many other families as possible?
Yeah. Wow. I think it's such a story that so many people can relate to these days, because our teens and young adults are really going through it. Mm-hmm. It feels like more than ever. Mm-hmm. And that may or may not be completely accurate, but it just feels like they need more support and more discussion about feelings. I think that, you know, many generations were raised not to talk about your feelings. Mm-hmm. And some feelings are bad. And I think we're learning through our young people how important that is and how much we need to support them in those areas.
Well, the research would back up what you're saying, that it has actually never been harder to be a teenager, and anxiety and depression have never been higher among these kids.
Yeah.
And again, people say why, and I think we all intuitively feel that it has something to do with comparison, social media, and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're finding. People are, particularly young people, between the ages of 13 and 25, our developmental goal is to find our identity. And that identity is tougher to find when you're constantly feeling like you're being compared and you never get to take a step off of that treadmill of comparison, and you never really feel like you're measuring up. And as adults, we do that. We look at who's having the best vacation, who's giving them the nicest house. But for teenagers, it's extra exhausting. And again, when I was growing up, there was only one phone in the house. We had to share it among the siblings and whatnot. So, and you were actually able to go to bed and not worry about what was happening everywhere. So for so many kids, and particularly our kids with ADHD, our kids who are, they're just wanting connection.
Yeah, I can't imagine what our kids are going through now as far as like always having to worry about what people are saying about you publicly, right? It's tough. I have two young adults and they are constantly trying to navigate difficult social situations online and worrying about how that might impact their future, right? If they're on a conversation that's been recorded and somebody says something, then they need to worry about that and future employers finding it. And it's just such a different world. And I think unless we really take time to discuss it and think deeply about it, like we are here, we don't recognize it, but we really need to.
Well, and that's why animals are so much more even incredibly powerful now, because you can talk to them and they are just, they're not going to pick up their phone while you're talking.
Right. They're not going to take a video.
No, they're going to give you their full and undivided attention. And we know the research says that just staring in the eyes of a dog can increase the production of oxytocin, which is that connection hormone, which helps people to feel bonded. Some of the research by Dr. Janet Oig-Gerlach of University of Toledo found that cats are actually better than dogs in helping to reduce symptoms of depression. So I found that really fascinating because I'm more of a dog person. And, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about emotional support animals. People think of dogs when they think of emotional support animals. But an emotional support animal is just any animal that being in contact with it reduces the frequency, intensity, or duration of any mental health symptoms that a person may experience. So again, you can have an emotional support animal that's a tarantula, that's a lizard, that's a fish. It doesn't have to be a dog or a cat or something furry. And people often think that they have to get their animal registered. But the registration of emotional support animals is not for the pet, it's for the person. So when I, as a therapist, am writing an emotional support animal letter, what I'm saying is that in my clinical judgment, the person that I'm talking to has a disability that the symptoms may be benefited by contact with an animal. That's all I'm saying as a clinician. So it doesn't have to be proven. It doesn't have to be anything. And that bar for what a disability is not nearly as high as what we would think of as if you're trying to get funding for Social Security or things like that, or workman's comp.
Right.
The law is written to make sure that almost everyone, particularly if they have anxiety, depression, those kind of things, if they're on the autistic spectrum, they will pretty much automatically qualify for getting an emotional support animal.
Wow. And that letter, I can just imagine people wondering, why do I need a letter to have an emotional support animal? That gives you the rights to have that animal in certain environments where maybe it would otherwise be prohibited, right?
Right. So the letter is primarily for where you live. So if you have an emotional support animal letter, and if you live in housing that's covered by FHA, so like apartments that have more than like four units and that are not necessarily owner occupied, then they have to allow you to have your animal, no matter what kind of animal it is, no matter what the breed is, they have to allow you to have it, and they can't charge you pet fees. And so this is all can also apply to, you know, colleges and universities, and sometimes they may ask for things like extra forms to be filled out. And very frequently, what they're asking for is in violation of the law. They're not allowed to ask you what your disability is. They're not allowed to, but they sometimes do. And then you have to get, sometimes you have to get HUD involved, or I was literally just emailing with a college student who she may have to have a Title IX investigation at her college because they're giving her a lot of pushback about getting her cat in her dorm room. So sometimes it can be challenging. But again, it really does mostly apply to just your dwelling. So people who talk about, oh, there's all these emotional support animals and they're in the supermarket and they're wherever else. Well, that legally, your emotional support animal doesn't have any right in most states to be in anywhere other than your dwelling.
Okay.
So when you see animals out and about, the only ones that have the legal right to be anywhere are service animals.
Gotcha.
And service animals are those, like we think of like seeing eye dogs, or there are animals that are trained to spot epilepsy or for diabetes and those kind of things. So those are animals that get specific training to remediate and help out with a specific disability. And there are psychiatric service animals, and it takes about $12,000 to $15,000 to train one. And they're very, you know, bonded to the person. But those are not pets. Those are working animals. Whereas ESAs are more, you know, they can be your pet. And in the middle between ESAs and service animals are therapy dogs, or they can be therapy horses or facility dogs. So if you go to a hospital or a school and they have a dog that just stays there and helps people out, well, they get a certain level of training to make sure that they're non-reactive, that they're going to be able to be pet by random strangers and also not be too interested in going and getting food from the garbage, things like that.
Right, right.
So the training to become like a therapy dog, it takes several months and it's, you know, about $1,250, depending on where you are, dollars. And if people are curious about, could my dog become a therapy dog and go and visit other people and help them out, they should go to Alliance for Therapy Dogs, which is a great place to find more information about getting their animal trained, or if their animal would be a good fit. So many animals just don't have the temperament. They're a little too hyper, or they're, but so again, it's a great service. And a pause for Patrick. We do have a team of therapy dog handlers, but that group is only in the Chicago area, just north of Chicago where we do our visits.
Yeah.
So our ESA work is national. So anyone around the country, if they have a young person in their life, or if they're parenting young people. So if a person is 57, but they're dealing with depression or anxiety themselves, and they could benefit from an emotional support animal, they can go to Pause for Patrick's website. And we can help provide them up to $500 to acquire an animal and up to $500 for training of that animal.
Wow.
So, and that's just some basic skills training. And our goal is just to help as many people as we possibly can.
It's amazing. It's amazing. We're dog people, and I see such a difference in all of us when we just take a minute and sit with the dog and be present with the dog. And we just got a new dog not even a month ago. And we're finding already that he senses when he thinks that someone is upset or our other dog is upset, and he will come and be with you, which is amazing, you know? And I think they have a lot of times those instincts to be really supportive. The other thing I was thinking about as you were talking, one of my kids graduated from college a couple of years ago. There were all kinds of emotional support animals in her dorms, which I was really surprised about because I thought, wow, you know, it must be really tough to get that approved. But I was really happy to see that it's possible now. You know, there were cats, there was a rabbit, there were all sorts of different animals all over her campus for that, which I was really, really thankful to see, because I think that, you know, we just need to be more open to the things that work for people. What is going to help someone feel safe in an environment? Like, I imagine that Patrick, when he was at school and he would say, all I want is to go home and be with my dog, he didn't feel safe at school. He didn't feel settled and secure. And here on this podcast, you know, our audience, most of the kids that we have that struggle. They don't feel safe in different environments. And so imagining just having an animal that can help to temper some of that is such a gift.
Well, and it also helps with that interaction socially. For so many people who have social anxiety disorder, or, you know, again, like making eye contact with people can be really challenging. But when you have the dog, like, I know the names of more of my neighbor's dogs than I know the names of my neighbors. You know, it just really helps as a lubrication to help that social interaction. It helps not just the person on that floor that has the cat, but the four or five other people who are going to get to interact with that cat, you know, at different times. And again, I think we should think about it like the way we think about music. We all know that music helps people to feel best, to match their mood. But we have to be respectful of others when we're listening to our music. You know, we can't be blasting our music at 3 a.m. And similarly with our animals, we have to make sure our animals are not causing others discomfort. So whether that's taking care of their fur and their dander and their waist, whether it's making sure that they're not loud at different times. So again, another role that I have as a clinician when I'm helping people is to say, is this going to be the right animal for the space and time that you're in right now? So you might want a giant husky, but is it good for both the husky and for you to be in a little dorm room? Maybe a rabbit is a better fit for right now. So pause for Patrick, we almost say never say no, but we might say not yet.
Yeah.
Because we really want to make sure that the pairing is sustainable. Because it is really uncomfortable for people when that animal has to be rehomed. So, you know, and people wonder about, like, what is the ethics? Are all these therapists who people reach out to about emotional support animals, do they just give a letter to everyone? And the answer is no. But more often than not, our bias is going to be to say yes, just like we would say yes to a person exercising or a person listening to music.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we say yes unless there was a good reason not to?
I can imagine some people feel like distraction is an issue. I can remember when my son was really young in like elementary school, and he would have different like tools or things for maybe focusing, like fidgets, or, you know, one teacher had given him some games. So if he was like working a puzzle or something, he was able to listen better, right? But what happened was all the other kids wanted to see what he was doing all the time. And it wasn't a problem for the teacher, but it was a problem for him. He didn't want to be a distraction. He didn't want kids to be like crowding around and asking him questions, right? And so he would often resist some of that. But I think also too, I can hear like, you know, professors in a college or teachers in a high school saying, this is such a distraction. Everybody wants to pet the animal or something like that. So how do you help people navigate those conversations and those challenges?
Well, again, for most of the people who have an ESA, it's not going to be in the school. It's not going to be in the classrooms. You know, and if it's more of that like service animal level, it would be saying like, well, could a wheelchair be distracting? Could a person coming in with crutches be distracting? Yeah, it could be distracting. But if that's what that person needs in order to be able to access that environment appropriately, then it just isn't up for the professor to debate. And that's why, again, that extra training for therapy dogs and service animals is that they're working and they're really trained well to not be distracting to others. If other people are distracted by that, you know, to say, hey, if a person's truly beautiful or handsome, they might be distracting, but we don't ban them from classes, you know, so.
Such a good point. Yeah. And I think, too, that dies down over time. You know, people get really interested about something new, but eventually they're going to get used to it. And I would hope that a lot of schools would be open to it, because as I said, my son really struggled in that environment. And oh my gosh, if he had had an animal with him, just, you know, an hour a day at school, like if the school had a dog that was there, you know, it would have made a huge difference in just helping him to feel safe and having his nervous system be settled. So I hope that we keep moving forward in this direction of having more and more animals being part of therapy, being part of environments where people struggle.
Well, and if there are people listening to this and they think a facility dog, that's what we call a dog, like a therapy dog that stays at the school. And if they think a facility dog would be a good thing for their school, they should reach out to their school board members and say, we support this. A lot of people who are unfamiliar with facility dogs have a lot of fears about insurance and what if the dog bites someone or what if there's allergies. And what schools who have facility dogs have found is these problems don't occur. The animals that are trained to be facility dogs are picked because they are non-reactive. They also do. There are insurance policies. So God forbid something were to happen, and that gets calculated into the cost of having it. And that's an area of future growth for Paws for Patrick. Eventually, we want to get more into that space of helping schools to have those conversations with their school boards, with their administrators, to say, again, if we can help one family by putting an animal in there, we can help thousands of kids sometimes if we can get that facility dog that's there working. And so that is an area of future growth. And I hope more schools will be able to.
Yeah, me too. Definitely. I was just thinking as you were talking, when my son comes to talk to me about stuff that he finds challenging to talk about, he will call the dog up on his lap. And I just now made that connection that every time we have a difficult conversation or something, you know, that he just is struggling with emotionally, he's calling the dogs up to him before he even starts. And I had not really thought about it that deeply until we've had this conversation. So it's just amazing that there are so many options to help with mental health. And we just need to keep having these conversations so more people know about it. I mean, I can imagine a world where every school has a therapy dog. That would be just amazing. You know, sensory rooms and all of these other things that so many students need. And I think more now, you know, my kid was mostly in school pre-pandemic. And so it felt like we were just asking for things for kids who are neurodivergent. But now we have so many more kids who are struggling with depression and anxiety. So now there's even a bigger population, I think, in the schools who could benefit from lots of these different things, not just animals.
When we find that the animals help to reduce the stigma because everyone is so open about talking about how animals help improve their mental health. So if I took the most emotionally healthy person on the planet, but then I also paired them with an animal, they would probably be feeling even better. And what it helps us to realize is that like mental health, like self-esteem, isn't high or low. It's not good or bad. We're all a spectrum of people like a mountain range, and we have our good days and our bad days. And so the more we stop thinking about people with mental health issues in one category and healthy people in another category, and instead say, we are all these people and we all benefit from the animal. And dogs are just a great way for your average person to open up and to feel like comfortable talking about the ways that those animals make them feel better. And then that helps us to open into so many other aspects of talking about mental health and the way that our mental health differences can actually be strengths. And so that's what we find is reducing the stigma through introducing the animal in the conversation.
So good. Let's talk a little bit about the process, because I think a lot of people don't even know where to get started. Obviously, they can go to Pause for Patrick website. We'll link that up in the show notes and connect with your organization there. But just kind of if we could walk through that process a little bit so people understand what that might look like, I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah. So let's say a person realizes that they have, if they have a mental health disability, or they think they might, and they are a young person, they could reach out to Pause for Patrick. But any person, if they're working with a therapist, they could say, hey, I think I might benefit from my animal or getting an animal to be an ESA. So they can talk to their therapist about writing them a letter, or even again, their psychiatrist, a medical doctor, anybody who's in their health team could write one of these letters. If that person's not sure how to do it, you can refer that person to Pause for Patrick. You can refer them to me, and I will teach people how to write these letters, because it's a super easy thing to do once you learn how to do it. The main thing that has to go in the letter is the date, the fact that it has to be on the practitioner's letterhead. And as I said, the practitioner has to say that legally they are verifying that this person does have a disability and that it might be benefited. And that's really all that has to go into the letter. So people are sometimes concerned. I don't necessarily want to share my diagnoses with my landlord or other people, and they don't have to. So, and people, I think, should be cautious about who gets their medical information. So, again, if they're working with a medical practitioner, a therapist, anyone like that, they can ask them about it. And then once they get that letter, they can submit that to their landlord or to the university where they are living. Some places will say that it has to be renewed year after year. There's legally no reason for that. I mean, I wish anxiety ran out after a year. I wish ADHD stopped existing after a year. But, you know, we find that it's often easier just to write an updated letter than to fight with people on it. And so when talking to landlords and things like that about this experience, especially there are some people who don't fall under HUD and FHA, as I say, it's if it's an owner-occupied two flat, they don't have to allow you to have your ESA. So just explaining to them, this is how the animal helps me to feel my best. And this is what it does for me. And then very frequently, they'll be telling stories. If I'm that landlord, I'm nervous that my apartment's going to smell like cat pee. I want to make sure that I know that this animal's being taken care of. So the more you're expressing that you're responsible and that you're doing this for a reason, the more open they're probably going to be to that.
And then what about training? I know you said there were different levels of training.
As I said, training is not necessary.
Okay.
So for emotional support animals, don't require any training whatsoever. Your fish or tarantula doesn't require any of it. For those, as I say, therapy dogs, for the service animals, again, for therapy dogs, reach out to Alliance for Therapy Dogs. For service animals, you're going to want to probably Google your zip code and service animal training to find something that's local to you.
Yeah. I just wonder about that process too. Like, I think, you know, we think that it's going to be so expensive to have any sort of support animal. So it's so good to be letting everybody know here that an emotional support animal needs no specific training. Obviously, I think you need a good connection with the animal. You know, they need to allow you to connect when you need to connect. But other than that, there's nothing specific. And then we move to therapy dog, which you said was a more moderate cost, right? Versus a service animal. Okay.
Yeah. And we shouldn't be really trying to encourage people who are not animal people. There are some people who just don't like pets. And so if your child doesn't really like animals and they don't enjoy interacting with them, let's not try to put a square peg into a round hole. Let's reinforce the things that are working, but not push for something that isn't.
Such a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because there are kids who fear animals. There are kids who just don't connect with them. It's not their wheelhouse. And for them, it's not going to be beneficial. You can force it on them, but it's not going to work because they're not into it. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. Anything else we need to talk about before we wrap up? Anything else that you think people need to know about the process or just having that emotional support when it's needed?
Well, I just think the one other misconception that I'll share is a lot of the people who are, there's a lot of angry people online who are very, they actually love emotional support animals, but they're nervous that the rights of emotional support animals are going to get taken away because of what they would deem like scam websites or things like that. There are organizations like CertiPet or Petable that a person can go, and if you don't have a therapist and you want to find someone to write an emotional support animal for you, they will pair you with a clinician. And there is ethically and legally nothing wrong with CertiPet or Petable or any of these other organizations. These are clinicians who are actively interviewing a person and making sure that they meet the criteria. So again, if you're hearing that, oh, you have to be working with a person for 3 months, or you have to be certified in a different way, that's not true. There are some limitations state by state, so you want to check in your state what the laws are. But in general, it's up to the clinician's judgment of, does this person qualify? And again, when I was working in an emergency room, I had to decide in an hour if a person could go home or if they had to be hospitalized. So I think I can figure out in an hour whether or not a person might benefit from an emotional support animal. So, and people say, well, why can't we make them wait a little bit longer? Well, I've worked with a couple of people who are in homeless shelters who won't leave for housing unless they can have their animal with them. This is really important to people. So why would we put extra barriers in the way of people who can truly benefit from this resource?
Such good work you're doing, and I appreciate all that you're doing to support emotional support animals, but also your work in mental health and just helping people. It's so great to get to be a helper in the world. I'm sure you feel that way too, and I appreciate each person who's doing that. So I thank you also for providing some of your time here and your wisdom and letting everybody know, really myth-busting, because even I thought emotional support animals had some training, right? Like, I even came into this conversation and, and learned a good bit from you. So I know that it's really going to be beneficial to so many people. I do want to let everyone know that you can get links to Paws for Patrick, as well as Dan's podcast, and also anything that we've mentioned. So things like CertiPet and Petable, I will link all of that up for you at the show notes. And you can get those at parentingadhdandautism.com/262 for episode 262. And I certainly encourage everyone to connect and learn more and see if you or your child or your students at your school might benefit from some of the work that Paws for Patrick is doing. And I just thank you again, Dan. It was a pleasure. And I will see everyone next time. Take good care.
Thanks for joining me on the Beautifully Complex podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share. And don't forget to check out my online courses and parent coaching at parentingadhdandautism.com and at thebehaviorrevolution.com.